Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast, where we teach you a single shot or strategy every single episode. I'm Michael O'Neill here in sunny Long Beach, California, joined by my good pal, Mr. Scott Fliegelman, on site in San Antonio for the, is it the fifth and penultimate championship there in San Antonio of NPL, Scott?
You are in a tiny group of people, smart people, Michael, who use the word penultimate accurately.
Hey!
It is the fifth of six.
Yes.
Now, the sixth one is the championships where, you know, all the marbles and the dollars will be handed out next month in Glendale, Arizona. But we're here in San Antonio and, you know, game on tomorrow. I'm in my home two suites room back at I scooted out of the country line dancing event back at Chicken Pickle. I kind of left my teammates hanging, but I had this important podcast to record with you.
Did you do-si-do on the way out? That was the real question.
I may have sashayed towards the exit. I don't know. This could go on.
Yes, it could indeed. A couple of quick bits. Number one, tragically, heartbreakingly, the clinic that we've been chatting about over the last couple of episodes, we have to push it until 2024. We have some scheduling conflicts that we've got to deal with, Scott. So that's a sad time for both of us.
Yeah, that's on me. My apologies to our listeners. It's our first 3.5 months in business at Boulder Pickleball, and we run into some conflicts, and we don't want to have to work around those. So we're going to get back to you when we've got the flexibility and the open courts to host a great 4.0 to Pro live event. So stay tuned.
Indeed, we will do that. Folks, thanks as always for sharing the show. It's super important if you guys listen to this and you enjoy it, that you leave us a rating and or review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you'd like to do that, it's 402p.com/Apple or 402p.com/Spotify. And finally, if you'd like a carbon paddle for 10% off, use the promo code 402p at checkout. Scott, at long last, by popular demand, we have two episodes that people have been asking for. One is the singles episode, which is how you pick up a date on a pickleball court.
Of course, of course.
No, it's the singles episode, and it's this one, which is the transition from tennis to pickleball episode. This is something that no matter what side of the coin you're on, if you are one of us tennis folks that came over to pickleball, or you have witnessed some tennis players, and maybe you have a friend that's been playing tennis forever and they're coming into the pickleball world and maybe don't have a 100% perfect idea of the type of things they need to adapt to this very unique game in some ways, this is the episode. So this is the one to point them towards. Make sure you, even if you're not that person, you recommend this to other tennis friends you have, because I think that they will improve their pickleball game from that. So let's first start at the 20,000 foot view here, which is the sort of initial mindset and some of the top level stuff from transitioning from tennis to pickleball.
Well, as on-ramps into pickleball go, tennis is the best. You know, there are other paddle sports, racket sports, court sports that are nice, but I have not found anything better to accelerate the learning curve into pickleball better than tennis. But I do like to say, and I coach a number of transitioning, converting tennis players, that 82% empirically gathered data, by the way, yeah. 82% of your tennis is very helpful, very relevant to your pickleball. But that leaves 18% that I call, you know, a bitch when it comes to unlearning certain habits. And that's really difficult for tennis players. And then building some less than intuitive new habits. So we start with that and we go from there.
It's funny, I went from tennis, you know, somewhat high level-ish, you know, it was tournaments and stuff in high school and that kind of thing, college. And then racquetball at a fairly high level as well. I would have been probably a 5-0 racquetball player if there were such a way to measure. When people say, oh yeah, you transition from racquetball, there's no shot that transitions from racquetball to pickleball other than an ATP. It's the only one that's low and flat that really directly translates to racquetball. Otherwise, we've just got court movement. We've got lateral movement and burst that I would say that is a little more akin to racquetball than tennis. The burst, tennis can be a very flowy game because there's so much court to cover. You've got to hustle, you got to get to where you're going, but you know, there's typically you got a couple of seconds to prep your racket to hit the ball. Racquetball is an instant racket prep kind of sport. And I would say pickleball is a little more likened to that than the flowiness of tennis. It's like you really have to get your body in position as quickly as possible in pickleball, especially the closer you get to the net.
Yeah. And much of that is just the ginormous court that the tennis is played on. And at the beginner intermediate level, the ball doesn't move all that swiftly, you know, over that, you know, large area. I just watched a decent amount of U.S. Open tennis last week, which was amazing. And, you know, as a former professional tennis player, I've highly enjoyed all of it, but I was really stuck on the just amazing footwork throughout the fortnight. Yes. Just, I mean, it's a lot of ground they're covering against the best tennis players in the world on the other side. And not surprisingly, all kinds of focused on the beautiful split step that they do right about the time the ball's on their opponent's racket. And like we've said on the show, no matter where you are, I mean, if you want to be at center court, then, you know, get your butt over there as fast as you can. But no matter where you are, when the ball's on your opponent's racket or paddle, you need a thousandth of a second split step, load your springs and react to where the ball goes. And these darn players are just so good at it. And not just for 25 minutes. I mean, they're out there for 4 hours. So, you know, all that off-court training that they do, it's just pretty impressive to watch their footwork and their speed and their reaction time.
One thing I will say is that pickleball to me feels a little more like old school, like 70s, 80s, early 90s tennis in its stroke concepts in terms of like turning your body to step into a forehand or a backhand, whereas a lot of modern tennis is squared up. Like the shoulders are more square to the baseline than they used to be. You know, it's more open than it used to be. And then the swing path of the racket to me is radically different than what I learned, than what many of us learned, you know, low to high, you know, going from right to across your left shoulder if you're hitting a right-handed forehand. Now it's this crazy spinny, loopy thing that looks very different. The grip is very different. The stance is very different. But I would say in terms of that, if you are a tennis player transitioning, you're probably looking a little more old school tennis than you are new school.
And speaking of old school, I mean, I think there's some real similarities with the old wooden rackets and what that required to play good tennis with. And perhaps a lead in to, again, how I start a lot of lessons with converting tennis players is a discussion and acknowledgement that the founders' vision in pickleball was driveway sport. And they carved, they sawed, they crafted the wooden paddles out of plywood and a jigsaw. And the current caretakers of the game are working really hard to keep it that way. And, you know, losing in some ways, you know, with the modern era of paddles, but, you know, still a glorified stick and a wiffle ball. And as such, combined with the tiny court, especially for tennis players, it makes it very difficult to play any winning pickleball from the back court.
Right.
The equipment we play with works pretty well when hitting down, hence the reasons why we work so hard to get to the non-volley zone for an enjoyable session of a four-person ritual kitchen exchange. But it is important to go over with converting tennis players that they should not aspire to play winning pickleball from the backcourt.
Well, I stepped on the court with my brother 2 or 3 months ago, and it felt like I was standing on a football field. Like, it just was crazy how big the court felt compared to what I'm now used to, where you can fit four of these courts on one tennis court. We very often see when someone first comes on from tennis, it's very interesting because it's almost like the first 10 days you go, you know, you're like, wow, I got this. This is going to be great. And sure enough, you walk in and you've got nice footwork and your ground strokes look pretty good. And, you know, maybe you have a one-handed backhand that may eventually find its way to be a two-hander. But then the nuance of the game starts sneaking up on you. And that part where you were so solid and hitting these great baseline shots, and very often we see it on the pro level when new pros come in and they play singles, well, they look pretty good until the other person comes up on every return. And now all of a sudden they're struggling because they don't have as much of a lane to hit that passing shot. And now they have to start going, all right, how am I going to work my way up to the net, and et cetera, et cetera. But that singles transition seems to be much easier than doubles, which to me is 90% different game in pickleball. you know, and much less congruent to tennis.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm glad you clarified that, because at Boulder Pickleball, we have, you know, a number of local tennis players who come check out pickleball, and two of them show up. I mean, why wouldn't there be two? They
right.
just expect they can go hit some balls. And they show up, they borrow a couple of demo paddles, and they whack some pretty nice looking groundies from
yeah.
the baseline. And that's fine. Like if that's what they want to do and that's what's fun, then great. And if they aspire to more, we're there to help. But you're right. I mean, the conversion to doubles is huge. I was, you know, a really solid singles player right off the bat, and it took quite a bit longer to get really good at tubs.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned something about, it's very tennis from the baseline, even the early transition zone, but the closer you get to the non-volley zone, the more you start talking cornhole.
Yeah, this again, I spend a lot of time on court with converting tennis players, and I do say that serve, return, if there happens to be a ground stroke, if they happen to get a lob over your head and you make it back to the baseline, use your tennis skills. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's fine to go ahead and hit a ground stroke from back there. But the closer we get to the net, because the ball doesn't bounce very high, there's no strings in your paddle or racket, there's no felt on the ball, and there's only 22 feet of landing zone on the other side, the tennis is not all that helpful until the ball gets up. And then our volleys and our overheads, you know, can take over. So in between those two things, I like to reference cornhole and actually frequently stop play, have my players put their paddles down on the court. I toss them the ball, have them catch it, and ask them to underhand toss the ball to a target that I have probably in the cross court kitchen, which is usually about the length of a cornhole shot. And, you know, we start off never evers with cornhole, but I'll take, you know, 3-5, 4-0, 4-5 converting tennis players and remind them that the right shot here when the ball is 10 inches off the ground is a soft ball that leverages the non-volley zone on the other side and lands at their feet. And that's a cornhole shot. It's an image that makes a lot of sense for them. And I want it to land softly like a beanbag would.
Once they're up there, I very often see new tennis players, when they hit a volley, it always has slice on it. They're hitting it sort of closer to their body and chopping down to slice every volley, which is what we were taught. It's volley 101, which keeps the ball in the court on a tennis court, versus that punch volley that we prefer with a little less slice on it in pickleball.
I remember being at the Tournament of Champions 4 years ago in Brigham City, Utah, and watching Lucy Kovalova play singles. And she's hitting these topspin swinging volleys, punch volleys, topspin volleys. I wanted to go out onto the court and correct her. I thought she was doing something wrong until I took a closer look at the way the plastic ball reacts on the court, which is quite a bit different than the rubber cord ball with felt on it that hits and really slides away on a tennis court, but kind of sits up on the pickleball court, whereas that topspin volley hits and really takes off away from the player. So not surprisingly, I adopted that within a couple of weeks.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you look at the tendency of a tennis player to slice their volleys, it just makes perfect sense. And someone, you know, in a professional coaching role likely needs to present them with alternatives, and or they get their butts kicked by players on the other side who are hitting volleys that are more appropriate to pickleball.
Well, one thing at the highest level of this, again, if you are in transition or have a friend who's going from tennis to pickleball, I do think you have to stay really open-minded about this. I think one of the first lessons to be learned is that pickleball is very different than tennis, especially in doubles. There's just a lot more nuance. The shots are, you know, you said 18%. I would argue it's higher than that in terms of the pickleball specific shots that have to be learned. I think that the tennis transition, you know, in terms of ground strokes, movement, yeah, that's all great. But I think once you take two or three steps into the transition zone, you got to start thinking that this is a new, unique experience. And I would start taking notes from the good people in your area in terms of how they're playing the point, how they're getting up to the net. Very few times do you see someone, especially in doubles, where, you know, they hit a banging baseline shot and then they just keep following it up with banging shots until they earn their way to the non-volley zone. It's very rare or never that I see that happen. It's almost always, if we're going to hit a drive on that third, it's almost always followed up by a fifth drop. Maybe there's a chance that if that fourth ball comes up and it's really high, you've got something to do with it and you can put it away or do something with it. But most often, the smart players, the better players, are a softer game. They're cornholing on their way up to the non-volley zone.
There we go. And let me add one, you know, bit of texture to the slice volley conversation. One of my favorite players and partners in the split age pro events, Megan Fudge, you know, came into the game about a year and a half ago, along with her husband, Ryler DeHart. And if you saw Megan a year ago, she was hitting a lot of slice volleys. You know, this was just a natural, I mean, a high level tennis player, but a lot of slice volleys. And you watch her game now and the progression, the nuance, the knowledge, the IQ of the game has just, you know, improved exponentially. And she can still put underspin on a volley, but she can also roll over it and punch it and do all the things that it takes to be, you know, a multiple medalist on the pro tour.
Once you get through that couple of baseline shots and you get your, you know, drives out of the way, probably the dink and the drop are the two most important skills that you probably didn't have as a tennis player. Like, okay, maybe you have a good drop shot and some do, but it's this also very slicey thing in tennis where you're sort of doing a big racket motion that you're really chopping to get that thing to drop like on the other side of the net and just stay there. Not the case for pickleball, because as we know, it doesn't really go that high anyway. So I think that the drops from everywhere on the court and the dinks are, to me, the two most important shots that a tennis player can learn that are probably the biggest fundamental baselines of pickleball.
Totally agree. And you always represent on this show really well when it comes to drilling. And, you know, perhaps I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but one great thing that you can do if you happen to have a dozen balls or a basket of balls is place a, you know, a 20, 30 gallon trash can on the other side of the net, cross court from you in the kitchen. And you can do this by yourself of just dropping the ball and hitting the ball with arc and trying to softly drop this ball into the trash can. I've mentioned cornhole, you know, earlier, and you know, this is our best representation of that, and just visualizing and getting down the ideal trajectory, which is loftier than your tennis brain would like you to think. It's better than putting a cone or water bottles or anything like that, because you can get away with a line drive. But if you're going to drop it into a trash can, you're going to need some loft on that ball, which, as you said, like once we take a couple steps inside the baseline, this is how pickleball is played. And this is tricky for tennis players to figure out.
And there's a part of that where I think a lot of these players, you know, I was about to say, let's not reinvent the wheel, but a lot of these transitioning tennis players have invented or have brought over some shots that we didn't see 3 years ago that are now much more integrated into the game. So I think there is a give and take in that regard. The other thing, though, that I think is super important, just as a baseline concept, is that your shots need to be way, way, way more compact than they are in tennis. Someone mentioned once that they never try to let their paddle get out of their peripheral vision. And I thought that's a really good way to visualize a compact swing. I'm always able to see my paddle. And I always think of James Ignatowicz, who I think made a conscious decision over the last year, 2023, to completely compact his swings. His game today looks different than it did a year ago because his paddle is so much more compact. And it's gotten better. I mean, that's the point, is that all of his game has gotten better the more compact he's gone. That and something that you shared with me, which is the swing path in tennis, is very often the topspin is from 6 to 12. But in pickleball, if you can get that dwell time a fraction of a second longer on the paddle and make that swing path on a forehand, if you're a righty, from 5 to 11, so there's a little bit of side and top, and the backhand from 7 PM to one. Again, this is like if you're looking at a clock, you get just a little better shape on the ball than you would if you were just doing that sort of standard topspin 6 to 12. And I think that's something that you mentioned to me, Scott, that's been, I mean, a huge difference from dinks to drives to kind of everything in between. That shape is an indicator that you've hit the ball the correct way.
Yeah. And this dwell time data that comes from 5 to 11, you know, with the forehand, was gathered in the same lab that provided us the 18%.
Yes.
So this, we're just making this up.
It's as accurate as you can get, you guys.
Yeah. But, you know, so it's not been measured other than from the success of the operators of this approach. By getting a little bit around the outside of the ball, we can get the top that we need. We can get that ball to, you know, quote unquote, stay on the paddle a little bit longer, but it's all about the shape. We need it to rise a bit and we needed to dive aggressively on the other side in a tiny court, tiny landing zone.
So one thing that happened when I was at a speaking gig of earlier this year, and I mentioned this a few episodes ago, is I was actually using a two-hander playing ping pong, which I didn't know was a thing. And it actually apparently is a thing because some people do it. It gave a semblance of more control than I had ever thought. And I think if you had a one-handed backhand in tennis, it might, I don't know, behoove you. This is going to be the vocabulary episode to consider doing a two-handed backhand, because I think you can get a little better shape. I think we can do that 7-1 that we talk about. Mattias Johansson, who's the number one senior pro singles player, was talking about whenever he plays a guy who has a one-handed backhand, he always returns to that deep right corner to make them try to dig a cross court one-handed backhand on that return of serve. It's really hard. Like he almost always wins that point.
I think one of the reasons why you're enamored by the two-hander, as am I, and we've talked about on the show, is that as right-handed players, it's not even really a two-handed backhand. It's kind of a lefty forehand with a little bit of help. And to the aforementioned goal of getting, you know, from 7-1 on the clock face, that's the left hand doing that, you know, to get around the outside of the ball. So yet another reason for our listeners to give it a go. And you've shared before, Michael, using a wall to drill this is a pretty easy thing to do.
Yeah. So in pickleball, I think things happen a lot more rapidly than on a tennis court. Now, the ball is flying way faster on a tennis court. You get a high level tennis and they're running back and forth for like 40 shots and it's amazing. That's generally not the case for most of us. The game is a much slower. You have a 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds between when you hit the ball to when you get the ball back. Whereas in pickleball, the closer you get to that non-volley zone, the shorter that time becomes, which necessitates something that we drill every single episode, which is split step. You have to be balanced to hit a good shot on the court. Your core has to be balanced. Your head should be up and you should be still. And that allows you to get a better stroke on this ball that much like a golf shot, can kind of go anywhere with this, you know, wiffle ball on this small paddle. So the better we can do of keeping that face from any articulation that we don't want, that's better. The ball's going to go where we want it to go. So we're trying to eliminate variable. And I think a lot of tennis players come in with very loose wrists and swingy arms where they're trying to do too much with every single ball that they get. Like they want to just put a ton of junk on every ball they hit. And I'd rather see it go like, well, first to hit it where you want it to go. And then if you want to like take that shot and start adding some spin to it, feel free, but don't overspin it just because you want to put a bunch of spin on the ball and then drill it into the net or drill it out of the court.
Yeah, we say split step every single show because it's that important. And in this case, it falls neatly into that 82% of your highly relevant tennis experience. And I really hope that you had a great tennis coach at some point along the way who drilled home the importance of split step so that you have that on day one. In pickleball. And this is the 4-0 pro show. So you've been at this for a little while, but you should have brought that onto the pickleball court. And if you don't have it down, please, you know, consider hiring a coach, maybe, you know, a former tennis coach or current tennis and pickleball coach, but a coach who's really good at teaching the split step. It's just, we can't stress enough how important it is to playing really good pickleball, especially from 4-0 pro.
Well, it's like you need the rudiments of pickleball. I'm a drummer, so I think of things like technique and rudiments are the core of drumming. And if you just understand what you're trying to do, if you have some idea, which is why it's such a good idea to you know get a lesson with a guy like you or anybody that really understands the differences between the two games. If you do that right at the very beginning, you're going to be in such a better position than if you're just kind of winging it and going, oh, I'm going to figure this thing out myself and or I'm going to reinvent pickleball based on my vast tennis experience. In fact, I just played with a dude the other day who could not have been less interested in learning the nuance of pickleball. He was great singles player. He beat me in singles. We were competitive, but he was great. I mean, he was a very high-level singles guy. He doesn't even play doubles. He doesn't know how to do it. And even when we're dinking on this short game, he was doing exactly what I just said, which is like every ball, he was just trying to do so much spin and weird stuff to it. And he was just, you know, every fourth ball was in the net. I'm like, bro, just hit it here. Mm-hmm. and then worry about that as you advance down the line, but at least get the strategy down first so you understand why you're doing the shot you're doing right now. That actually goes in with the what we talked about before, which is like a lot more big muscles than small muscles. So a lot more shoulders and quads, using your arm as a lever versus wrists and elbows. Again, tennis can be very wristy and elbowy these days. Just with it, like I see the stroke and it reminds me of like Gumby or something. Is another a dated reference, very modern reference on my part is Gumby. I weirdly think that it's like, sometimes I say, think about yourself as Frankenstein. Think about your arms just being these levers, the shorter you get to the net. And again, less variable. That's how we eliminate these mistakes, is less variable if you can.
And you clarified there perfectly that the closer you get to the net, the more we want to be, from a joint standpoint, shoulders and knees, and less elbow and wrist. And once we're back at or behind the baseline, use your tennis strokes, you know, especially if we're trying to hit a line drive. As we march forward, we need to convert that. And I mentioned it earlier as cornhole, which is kind of a long lever type of a toss. And we need the same sort of thing. Bend your knees and use your shoulder joint.
What's your opinion on, they're at the baseline, they hit that first drive, and then maybe they're in the transition zone. There's so much slice that I see from tennis folks, like all the way into the, you know, we talked about the volleys already, but all the transition zone, it feels to me like slice, slice, slice. And I want to like say, hey, try tuning a bit of that slice out. This light wiffle ball just tends to sit and float and stay up. You can benefit from it if it's got so much backspin on it that as soon as someone gets a paddle on it, they drive it right into the net. Great. Again, sometimes I will face that as the server, and the return is so good, typically from tennis folks, they do a massive slice on that return, and it can be very challenging to get that third ball to go where you want it. But once that's done and you're working your way up to the net, man, I tend to think a little less slice is better, but I'm curious about your perspective on it.
Yeah, it's nuanced, and I think it's kind of what words we need to use to imagine the actual strokes that you're talking about. For example, when I'm in the transition zone and the ball comes to my backhand and I need to hit a soft cross-court 19-foot drop shot, my best way of doing that is with some underspin on the ball.
Right.
You know, if I want to drop it into a trash can in the kitchen cross-court from me, hitting a flat ball, I'm not going to have much control.
Yeah.
Hitting topspin, riskier endeavor. I'm not as good at that. So I'm going to have some controlling underspin on the ball in order to hit my target. Now, if it happens to land softly because of some backspin, a la, you know, a Dave Weinbach drop that doesn't really bounce very high because of all the underspin, then great. But the primary reason for me is control and accuracy. And that's a slightly different shot than what you're describing as a slice backhand is more of a line drive with a ton of underspin on it. Mine
Correct.
Is more of a floating ball.
Right.
That's designed to land softly in a trash can in the non-volley zone.
Yeah, mine has a much more violent cut on the ball to get a ton of underspin. And it's fine, but when someone does that from 2 feet inside the baseline, you tend to see a lot of those balls float wide or float long because the ball's not dipping. It's got so much backspin on it that it floats. And that's the thing I'm suggesting maybe you tune, you know, maybe it's a little less, maybe it's underspin versus slice. Maybe that's the distinguishing factor.
Yeah. And let's put it in under the heading of cornhole. Like if we're going to use a technique to get a ball to float on an arc 20 feet, then, you know, light underspin, controlling underspin is better than slice, violent slice.
I think the plus side of that is that you already know how to do it if you're a tennis player. You already know how to do it, but just do it a lot less than you're doing it. And I think with intention, do it a lot less.
How few balls would Roger Federer need to hit from the transition area with his backhand to be able to put 100 balls in a row in the kitchen, you know, cross court? I think three.
Until he understood, needs a lot less stuff.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful slice backhands in tennis history. He would make the modifications in very short order.
Right.
To be able to use his existing skills.
Yeah.
Modified to hit that target once he understood the importance of it. Now, there's only one Fed, no offense, Federico Staxrud, but we're not quite there yet.
Right.
But yeah, that's the difference I think we're talking about. You have the existing skills, they just need a little modification.
To wrap this up, I'm going to put you a little on the spot. A few months ago, they had the, whatever they called it, but it was John McEnroe, Michael Chang, et cetera, et cetera. You know, obvious real tennis legends. I'm curious what you saw at the beginning and then at the end of that exhibition round, if you can remember how you watched it and what you saw as a coach from those people that only knew tennis and in fact were kind of down on pickleball at the beginning.
It's a pretty insightful question. You must do this for a living. But really, I mean, we've got four amazingly talented racket sport players who were pretty green when the show started. I observed that every 5 minutes, they got a quarter level higher in their rating.
Right.
Like, I really think they all started off at 4 point low something.
Right, same.
Yeah, and probably Michael Chang was the best at the very start. And I feel like at the end, he was the fourth best player on the court.
I agree with that.
The other three guys just kept getting better and better and better. And they applied their skills, but they detuned a little. They started to understand some of the soft game. And then, yeah, when the ball got up, they knew exactly what to do with it. And their serves and returns were great. And their volleys were great. And they started figuring out the midcourt and the kitchen play. And by the end of their few games, they were upper 4 point somethings. They were really getting good. And hopefully they've stuck with it. Can't wait to see them do it again.
Yeah, McEnroe was kind of the guy that if I had an example of someone doing that wicked slice from the transition zone, he was totally doing that at the beginning, certainly all through singles, he was doing it. And then, yeah, he started tuning it down a little bit to get the ball to drop. You know, there's only so many times you can feed a chest high ball to another athlete that will put it away before you go, oh, this thing's floating too high. I can't do that shot anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, when you've got Roddick and Agassi on the other side, those are some pretty good forehands.
Yeah, it's just a whole thing. But I think overall, though, if we go back to this 20,000 foot view, the concept of just take what you already have, take the shots that you've been training on your whole life, and then add to those things these dinks and drops, if you can just add those two things into your game in a way that you can become competent from anywhere on the court doing the drops and then getting some consistency in the dinks, you're going to be way better off than most people that didn't start from any sort of racket sport background.
And play some cornhole.
And play some cornhole. That's right. I like that. Do you, as a drill for that, Scott, do you recommend sort of walking around the court with a pickleball and kind of throwing it like you'd throw a cornhole bag just to get your body movement somewhat close to what it needs to be?
I did record a video on this. I'm going to have to try and dig it back up, but it's a game I call dropping the bucket. And I have, you know, I do it every 3 or 4 weeks at our clinics. Is to your point, we go to different spots on the court. We start off right at the kitchen line. And it's a fun game. I have, like, you know, two teams play against each other and we count how many balls end up in the trash can. You know, but underhand toss, bend the knees, shoulder joint dominated, long lever swing, and we see how many balls we can toss into the trash can. We do eventually throw the paddle back in our hand and play the same game. But it starts with demonstrating to oneself what the ideal arc and trajectory of a dink or a drop is supposed to look like. And the cornhole toss, whether it's with a beanbag or a pickleball, is a great way to show ourselves that.
Well, guys, if you are a former tennis player or someone who's getting into pickleball and you are struggling with it or you'd like to get a little better, I hope this episode helped. If there's something you think that we missed on this episode, picklehelp.com is where you can reach us. I get all of those emails and I pass them along. So we will absolutely follow this up. This will easily be the longest episode we've ever done, but we knew it was going to be a bit of a bomb as it's a bit of a complex subject. So I hope you enjoyed this vocabulary lesson as well as the transitioning from tennis lesson. Scott, good luck tomorrow, man. Kick some booty.
Thank you. We'll give it a go.
I'm sure you will. Will it be on the tubes?
It will.
Okay.
It will.
If you guys hear this on, this will be out September 16th, 2023. Jump on over to YouTube and see if you can tune in. I don't know how to get you guys this information, but maybe stay tuned to Boulder Pickleball on Instagram or 4.0 to Pro on Instagram. If I can find out what court Scott will be on, he's part of the Denver Iconics, then absolutely tune them in and maybe you can catch a couple games of him being the all-star that he is. Thank you, sir. Keep on rocking.
Yep.
go back to your country line dancing. Yeehaw. Folks, you've now just listened to another episode of 4.0 to Pro. Guys, go have some fun. Play some pickleball. Go hang out. Do some high fives. All right. Talk to you soon. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0 to Pro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.